Welcome to The Challenge, where we'll discuss the challenges that life gives us. Challenges from the perspective of people with disabilities, and challenges from those who encounter a disabled person in any walk of life. And now your host, Steve Bauer.
This is program number 33.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
This time we're going to travel to the Big Apple, New York City. My guest is Steve Matsura. Welcome into The Challenge.
Hi, Steve. Glad to be here.
You and I have known each other about, 7 years now. I first met you when I became involved with ACB Radio, and we've worked on many projects there, and our paths have crossed in other ways as well. So we know where we're starting from. How about giving us a little bit of information about your level of vision?
I was born in 1953, and back then you could only go blind for two reasons, either RLF or adventitious injury. But I broke the mold on that one because I was born congenitally blind, not totally. I had some light perception, but it wasn't caused, correction, it wasn't caused by over-incubation. It wasn't RLF. As a matter of fact, I was never incubated. Actually, I was 2 weeks late. I wasn't premature at all. So they never did figure out what the root cause of my blindness was, but it also came along with other complications, which got taken care of as my life went along. And about the time I was 15, 16 years old, I noticed my vision was starting to dim out. So they took me to an eye doctor, and they said I had early onset glaucoma.
Ooh.
So they took care of that as much as they could, but it got the better of my vision, and by the time I was 17, I was totally blind. Turns out glaucoma runs in my family. Several years later, my grandmother got it, and by the time she passed away, she was nearly blind. At the time of my father's passing in 85, he had just contracted some symptoms, and now it's my job to beat up on my brother to make sure he gets his eyes checked and doesn't go that way.
And your education, was it public or blind school?
Well, from the first day of nursery school to the last day of 12th grade, I attended the New York Institute for the Education of the Blind, which is now known as New York Institute for Special Education, and I graduated with a full Regents diploma from there. And for those of you not from New York and California, they have the special testing thing that they do in New York and California, which are state-based standardized tests called Regents exams. And they're nice and accessible, and they come in Braille and large print and whatnot, but they're a pain in the neck. You can graduate with either a Regents diploma or a non-Regents diploma, and I was lucky enough to be able to graduate with a Regents diploma. Afterwards, I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. There were a lot of things open to me. My parents wanted me to play music, and they wanted me to go to music school and whatnot, and I just didn't want to do that. So I decided to take a year and find out what high school for the rest of the world was like. So I applied for and got into my local high school in Hastings-on-the-Hudson and attended there for a full year as a senior matriculating student. I took the same course as everybody else did. I was graded the same way. Even though I had already graduated with a diploma, I was treated like a graduating senior. The only difference was that when it came time for graduation, I didn't graduate with the class.
Okay.
And I learned a lot. I learned not only the coursework, but what it's like to go to school in a sighted environment, to get your own readers and get your own work done on your own terms. And because I was just a kid, I wasn't working, might want to know how I got readers. I bartered with them. I bartered everything from tutoring and other subjects to my mom will cook you a great dinner, I'll do anything you want. Just read for me. That's all I want. And made a lot of friends, talked to a lot of people, and some of whom I still keep in touch with to this day. Then I decided I wanted to go to Middlebury College, and Hastings helped me get into there. But Middlebury was a big challenge because most of the things that I needed for schoolwork, most of the books I needed, I couldn't get fast enough. For example, they gave me the entire book list for an English class for an entire semester, 22 books. You give us 22 books, we'll give you a semester of English. By the time October rolled around, I think I'd gotten 4 of them. So I knew I was in trouble. And I was in trouble to the point where in April of my first year, I had to withdraw. It was either withdraw or fail, because I just couldn't keep up. Very, very fast-paced environment. So I came back home to Hastings, and I enrolled in community college, went there for a couple of years, and then got myself into NYU, where I studied computers right up until about, a semester and a half shy of a degree. If I ever went back to school, I probably would have most of a year to do, because it was just too much for me to keep up with. So I came back to Hastings, and I went to a community college for a couple of years, and then got into NYU, where I took up computer studies for another year and a half, but I never did finish NYU, so I actually have about maybe the better part of a year to go if I ever wanted to finish school.
I know sometimes people have talked about school and going back and getting their master's degree, and about 10 years ago, I thought about it for about a week. And then I decided that, hey, I'd made it this far without it, and I wouldn't do it. But
that's exactly how I feel. Everybody talks to me about going back and finishing up, and I said, why? I probably know more from my 27 years in industry than they can teach me in college. Not that I'm the brightest bulb on the tree, but, 27 years means something.
So you've got out into the world and worked in the field of computers. What kind of stuff did you do?
Well, before I got into computers, I was in a bunch of different rock bands in Westchester, and I made a lot of money, had a lot of fun, and also made a lot of friends, some of whom I still keep in touch with today, playing music in nightclubs and doing the musician thing. It was my parents' fervent hope that I would make music my career. But in the 70s, I didn't want to be the stereotype blind musician. I didn't want to be another Jose or another Stevie Wonder. I just didn't want that. And I fought them tooth and nail. I said, I really want to get into computers. They said, how are you going to do that? I frankly don't know, but I want it. So in 1979, when the Opticon was first coming out, I was given the opportunity to test for it, see if I could learn it. I tested good. And the State Commission sent me away for a two-week course up in Albany, and they said, if you can learn to use this, you might be able to work in a computer job.
But wasn't it, though, a little bit earlier for the Opticon? Wasn't it long about 74? Because I got my first Opticon in 77.
Well, they've been around since probably 70.
Yeah.
But it never occurred to anybody that it would be something that would be useful for me.
This is the best piece of equipment.
So it wasn't until 79 that they gave it to me. But I went through the class. Now, the neat thing is that I'd actually seen one back in 68 when it was in its developmental stage. There was a guy that used to work in our bookbinding department at the New York Institute by the name of Rick Joy, who knew the people who invented it. And he had one on loan. And I mean, this was a real breadboard operation. It was like in 5 different boxes all held together with spit and baling wire and God knows what else. But it worked. And it performed the same functions back in 1968 that the one that I got in 1979 did, only the packaging was different.
Do you still have it?
I do.
Oh.
I still have my original unit.
I've actually, let's see, I'm trying to think. I've got my second one. My first one, I traded it in to get the second one. And the second one is still sitting here on the desk. And I think I got it in 83 or 84.
Wow.
And I've actually got another one that's packed away safely in a box, stored away, just in case.
Well, let me tell you, you keep it. It's worth its weight in platinum. Gold.
I couldn't make it without the Opicana. I use it every day. And it just still makes me sad that the manufacturers and the people that sold it didn't really market it and use it to its fullest.
Well, what we're talking computers these days, that's what everybody seems to think the answer is to life, the universe, and everything.
Yeah, well.
But getting back to 79, right at the same time that I was getting Opticon training, a friend of mine who worked at a small software house said they had an opening. Could I come down for an interview? So I got some old program listings together and polished up my BASIC a little bit, went down for this interview, and they said, well, if you can get this technology that you're talking about that will read the screen for you, we'll give you a job. And the state said, well, if you have a job, we'll get you the Opticon training that you need, and we'll get you an Opticon. So it was a standoff for about 3 months, and finally the state caved in. And that's when they sent me for Opticon training in June of 79. And I came back and I worked for the software house, which was a real rinky-dink operation. I mean, boy, oh boy, you talk about low budget. Even the customers were low budget. And that lasted, as I said, for about 18 months. And then as the software house was sort of falling apart, I jumped ship and I went to the Bank of New York, where I had a very successful career for 13 years, doing all sorts of things with Lang BSs and DEC PDPs and the similar language, and just anything they threw at me, I ate it up. And in 1993, I guess it was, I moved to Chase of my own volition. I had a very pleasant parting with Bank of New York, and as a matter of fact, when I went to Chase, I still kept contact with the Bank of New York guys, because it turned out the division of Chase that I went to was doing a lot of work with the division of Bank of New York that I came from. So we had a lot of interbank communication, shall we say.
Oh, cool.
And Chase wound up purchasing me lots of technology. They got me the new, the second generation Opticon, I believe they call it the R2. And they also got me involved with JAWS for Windows and Braille display and the whole nine yards. And that went along really well until 2006, another 13-year career, when one day I got a phone call that said, you need to come to this conference. And the conference was with me, three HR people, and my boss. And the long story made very short is they attempted to accuse me of putting in a change out of profile. Now, changes in computers are very, very important. They have to be documented and scheduled almost down to the minute. Because if you're making a change while somebody's doing something important with a computer and you cause their process to screw up, it could wind up costing the bank millions and millions of dollars. Well, I sufficiently proved that the change that I put in was not out of profile, and I did not do it at the wrong time. They said, okay, fine. If we can't get you on that, we're going to get you on this. And they started throwing up all these things at me. I said, you know, this is ridiculous. What's the bottom line here? Well, the bottom line was that they wound up firing me.
That's
so
always
a 27-year in the IT industry came to a grinding halt on March 31st, 2006.
That's always a pleasant feeling.
Yeah, it was a pleasant feeling, not. But it was also, I learned very shortly thereafter, that it was just the tip of the iceberg. I was probably on the very, very tip of that iceberg, because it turned out that there were many people in other divisions that were getting the same routine done to them. As a matter of fact, it happened to one of my coworkers a year later, and they told him the only reason that we're not kicking you out the door is because you've been with the company for 25 years. I said, that's just the nice thing to be greeted with on a Monday morning, don't you think?
Was that person visually impaired?
No.
Okay.
But there were a lot of non-visually impaired people who were like, some because they wouldn't move to a new physical location, some because they wouldn't change jobs or take lesser positions, and some just because the department they were in closed.
Yeah, I think we find in many cases these days where not only the corporate climate, but technology moves in such a way that a person that is blind or visually impaired is sometimes left sitting in the dust, not because they're not qualified or willing to do the job, but the technology just goes in such a direction, and our access technology hasn't taken that deep breath and caught up yet.
Thankfully, this time, that wasn't the problem. It was an internal problem. I believe that the reason that I was let go had more to do with the fact that I was dealing with sensitive data, and I probably knew too much. And they didn't like that for whatever reason. And I knew too much about how things worked on the inside, and they didn't want one person with all that knowledge hanging around. So they fixed it so that it wouldn't be that way. And the things that I did got doled out to about five different people.
I'm Steve Bauer. You're listening to The Challenge on ACB Radio Mainstream. My guest this week is Steve Matsura from New York City. And so far, Steve, we've got you educated. We've got you with some college. We've got you playing some rock and roll music and doing things like that and working with computers. And we're 2 years later, and you are just about ready to start a new venture, or maybe, shall I say, a couple of new ventures. Tell me about those.
The internet being what it is, and me being all over it as I am, this is sort of something that was sort of inevitable, even if I wasn't looking for it. Years ago, about 25 years ago, actually, I dipped my big toe into what most people refer to as network marketing. Network marketing is where you sell product, and then you find people to sell product for you, and you make overrides on what they sell. Examples of internet marketing companies are things like Shackley and Avon, Nu Skin, Fuller Brush, I think, has a network marketing component to it.
Amway.
There's a bunch of them. Herbalife. There's a few of them out there that I'm sure you've heard of. Well, network marketing has taken a giant leap forward in technology, and it's now done completely on the internet. And the other great thing about it is it's almost completely paperless. And in some instances, it really is paperless, which makes it ideal for a blind person. And I'm working with two different network marketing companies right now, one of whom sells a collision deductible reserve plan, which helps you lower your auto insurance costs while giving you $1,000 in the hole in case you have a Donnybrook with another car. And another company I'm working with gives away free internet browser add-ons that look on shopping sites and gather price comparison information for you at the click of a mouse, so you can look for the best deals that you want and know what shopping sites have them. And how you make money off that is that every time you register one, you get paid an override, and the overrides get paid for by the shopping sites, who get their logos trademarked and displayed when you use this thing.
So then your goal then is to get people to download these plugins and start using them?
Just as many and as fast as possible. And also to find other people to do the same.
Okay. So let's go back to the insurance one. I'm intrigued. How does that work reduce your deductible?
What you do is you sign up with this company and you pay a certain amount of money per month. It's actually $25 a month over a 40-month period, and they sock it away for you. And after 40 months times $25, you've got $1,000 in the bank.
And they've been able to invest it and earn interest on it all along?
Yes, it's backed by Wells Fargo and Smith Barney, which are two very solid financial institutions.
Well, at least today.
And these days, who knows, but let's hope, as I knock wood. the reason that you would want to deal with saving the money in this manner, rather than putting away yourself in your own savings account, is, first of all, this is not a savings account, which means it bears no interest, which means you pay no taxes. So that's very important, because with the rate of interest the banks are giving these days, you're going to lose money. You're going to put $1,000 in, you might make 1%. With this plan, it's not a savings plan. It is a prepaid service that you can use if your car is in a crack-up and you need to go to the insurance company and say, I have an insurance claim. And then what you do when you have this thing is you call up your insurance company, you tell them you want to raise your deductible to the $1,000 limit, and your insurance rates get lowered. In some cases, as much as 40%, depending on where you live and what your insurance costs are and if you're a good driver and whatnot. And the bottom line is the plan winds up paying for itself over a very short period of time. However, after the plan pays for itself, your insurance rates are still low, so you keep saving money.
So what happens if you've got $400 accumulated so far and you have a fender bender?
Excellent question. I was just about to explain that, but glad that you asked. You get the full $1,000 worth of deductible as soon as you sign up with the plan. If you need it at any point, even if it's on the very first day before they've received your very first payment, you have access to it. All you have to do is pay back what you've used at the same rate of $25 a month. And there are discounts available for faster prepayment.
And what happens once you pay the $1,000 in? Do you continue contributing to this fund at $25 a month?
No. Once you pay the $1,000, you're done. And it stays with you for the rest of your driving career. There is an early termination fee if and only if your driving career is interrupted by loss of license due to illegal driving activity. But if you get to the end of your driving career and you're 70, 80, 90 years old, whatever it is, and you decide you're not going to drive anymore, you get a note from your doctor, you submit it, and you get your $1,000 back.
Well, how interesting. Let's go back to the shopping one. What about accessibility? Are these little things you download and install, are they accessible?
Oh, the accessibility on both of these programs is really, really good. As a matter of fact, I've only run into one little snag, and that is in the creation of flyers. They want you to... There's a space on the flyer where you can put your name, address, website, phone number, whatever, to hand out flyers to folks. And what you're supposed to do is get these things printed up on labels and hand stick them on the flyer before you give them out in the little space provided. Well, I'm working with the company who is producing the flyer, PDF, to allow me to either hand type it in there or give me the Word document, and I'll edit the Word document and put it in there myself, whatever it takes. But they're very amenable to working with me on this. Now, the accessibility of the websites is perfect. And the accessibility of the second business venture that I'm working on, which is a shopping thing, it's a little browser add-on that you install. And when you search for something on the internet, let's say you wanted to buy sheets and towels, just for argument's sake. It could be anything. It could be televisions. It could be bicycles. Anything you want. You bring up your favorite search engine, type in what you're looking for, and this little gizmo goes out and looks at, I think we're up to 9 different internet sites, things like eBay, Overstock, Walmart, all the big ones, Amazon, I can't think of them off the top of my head, all the big shopping sites that there are, shopping.com, all the ones I'm sure you've heard of. Goes out there and looks for the things that you are searching for, and then brings up a screen, one screen per site that you can tab through, and so you can comparison shop and find out who's got the lowest prices, and which one you want to buy from.
So the actual comparison shopping is done by you, not the plugin.
Correct.
It just does does the dirty work for you, going to all the sites, and just makes it easy.
Correct. It gathers it all together on one page, and you just look at that one page and decide which one you like, and then go for it.
Well, how cool. That could really speed up shopping for a person who's blind or visually impaired, because some of these sites, I don't care what they say, I think they're dreadful to get around on.
I agree with you 100%. And when I first looked at it, I thought of that. I said, you know, this could either be the greatest thing or it could be the worst thing. And it turns out it's pretty great.
If people would want more information about either of these products, are your websites going yet?
As a matter of fact, yes, they are. I'd be happy to give you both. You can take a look at the Collision Deductible Reserve Plan at www.mylowpremium.com. That's MYLOWPREMIUM.com. And if you want to look at the little shopping gizmo, you can take a look at www.bestshoppinghelper.com. BESTSHOPPINGHELPER.
Run those web pages by us again in case somebody did get a chance to write them down.
Oh, sure thing. For the Collision Deductible Reserve Plan, take a look at www.mylowpremium.com. And if you want to look at the shopping browser add-on, it's at www.bestshoppinghelper.com.
And if somebody wanted to contact you direct, how about an email address?
Oh, certainly. SM, that's for Steve Metzera, at dataguardian.com. And Data Guardian is DataGuardian. SM at dataguardian.com.
And if somebody wanted to call you on the phone, how about a phone number?
Okay, I'll give you my toll free. It's 866-458-4895. 866-458-4895. And that's good any time, day or night. And I'm in the Eastern time zone, so if you want to talk to me live and in person, call at those appropriate hours, about 8 in the morning till about 8 at night.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be part.
Well, that's our show for this week. If you've got audio feedback, our comment line is 206-350-2757. That's 206-350-2757. Or you can send us email to challenge8255@gmail.com. That's challenge8255@gmail.com. I'm Steve Bauer. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. We'll see you next time here on The Challenge.
Thanks for listening, and stay strong when encountering the challenges of life. Please join us next week at this same time for another edition of The Challenge from ACB Radio Mainstream.